Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, and with me today is my special guest, John Walcott. John is the Chief Content Officer and Editor-in-Chief of SmartBrief, which is a Washington-based online business news service. Welcome, John.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome to the show. SmartBrief has partnerships with more than 100 major trade associations, produces about 150 email newsletters in 25 industries with total readership, and I understand it's growing rapidly, of more than 4 million. He's responsible for content of all of the company's email and online publications and works to improve and expand the existing editorial products and develop new ones. Before we go into SmartBrief, I want to tell the listeners that we're in the presence of a print god. I mean, John was the national security correspondent at the Wall Street Journal, foreign editor and national editor of U.S. News and World Report, and Washington bureau chief of Knight Ridder and McClatchy Company after it acquired Knight Ridder in 2006. Of all the experiences that you've had, and you've won awards for your writing and for your publishing, what event stands out the most to you in terms of the things that you've covered over all these years?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer because it's been a lot of years. and because nothing I ever did, I did alone.
Didn't you report on the weapons of mass destruction situation in Iraq?
I did. Most of that work was done by Jonathan Landay and Warren Strobel and Joe Galloway at Knight Ridder.
Right.
And that is a chapter that stood out because they were almost alone in questioning the case that the administration made that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, was developing new ones, and had ties to al-Qaeda.
Right.
And that was something that, particularly the latter part of it, made no sense at all.
The ties to al-Qaeda?
The ties to al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda's objective was to overthrow secular regimes like Saddam's.
Right. So how could he be tied in? Just because
it made no sense.
Hatred of Americans or?
Well, he wasn't is the answer.
Right.
There were Iraqi exiles around who were claiming that he was.
Right.
But that claim made absolutely no sense. And what that triggered was the beginning of the questioning in our minds about the accuracy of what the administration was saying and the sources of it. And I have to tell you, Wayne, that the case fell apart very, very quickly. I'll give you two quick examples of how that worked. One of the arguments that was made and appeared in the press was that the Iraqis had a terrorist training camp at a place called Salman Pak, south of Baghdad, and they had the fuselage of an airliner, and they were using that to train people to hijack airlines. And obviously the suggestion was that they were training people like members of al-Qaeda.
Right.
Two phone calls went out to various suburban destinations in Washington, and the answer came back, yes, indeed, there is a camp at Salman Pak, there is an airline fuselage. But we've seen no evidence of anyone with foreign credentials or passports there, and it appears to us to be a counter-hijacking facility, a place where the Iraqis train their security guards to foil airline hijackings.
Sure.
Next question, well, who were the Iraqis afraid might try to hijack one of their airliners? Long pause. Well, al-Qaeda. So that story sort of fell apart.
Sure. This was after 9/11, of course.
This was after 9/11, but remarkably quickly after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
The first rumblings we got that the administration had begun to focus on Iraq rather than al-Qaeda or Afghanistan came, within a month of 9/11.
All right.
And those got louder and louder, and by November it was quite clear to us that the administration was intent on using 9/11 as a pretext to go into Iraq. And we reported that for the first time in mid-February of 2002.
Okay.
Warren Strobel and I did.
That's about 6 months after the event.
Yeah, and long before anybody else tumbled to it. But we were convinced by mid-February.
So what led you to the conclusion that there were no weapons of mass destruction?
Well, we were never able to be certain about that because the regime in Iraq was a deceptive and untrustworthy one. The problem was that so were the sources claiming that there were weapons of mass destruction. And the harder we looked at that, the more the sources of those reports appeared to be dubious. Now, one of the ones that we've, within the past few weeks, finally seen the source of up close and personal was this notion that he had mobile bioweapons labs disguised as milk and yogurt trucks. And my reaction to that...
I'm smiling.
I was going to say, the audience can't see you, but that was exactly our reaction to that. Wait a minute. There was another one that claimed he had a secret bioweapons lab in the basement of one of his own palaces.
Okay.
Which I was frankly somewhat skeptical of.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
It made no sense to me at all.
He jeopardized his own welfare with one of these labs potentially dysfunctioning or something?
It made no sense. There was another one where it turned out that the source of these reports was a Kurd.
Mm-hmm.
Again, a natural enemy of the regime.
Right.
They'd been virtually at war. We had a no-fly zone over northern Iraq to protect these people.
Correct.
A Kurd would have had the full run of all his secret facilities. It made no sense. And when we reported those things out as best we could, they all fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
At a minimum, there was absolutely no, never mind conclusive, even reliable evidence to suggest that that was true. And moreover, almost every one of these roads led back to one person, and that was the Iraqi exile Ahmed Chalabi and his circle of friends.
Right.
And Chalabi was a fellow I had met. He often stayed at a home that's right adjacent to the Georgetown campus, right behind the nursing school, in fact. And this was a fellow who did business in the Middle Eastern way,
right?
In which you can't take anything at face value.
There are no contracts.
No, there are no. Well, there are contracts, but they're not worth the paper they're written
Correct.
On. And every rug that was ever sold to you was made 5,000 years ago by some member of someone's family and has 2,000 knots to the inch.
Right.
So, as Ronald Reagan used to say, trust but verify, and the verification just wasn't there for any of this stuff.
Well, that revelation obviously came to haunt the Bush administration and those involved with it, including Rumsfeld, who just came out with a book. Do you have any feelings about what's happening in the Middle East today with all of the protests and regimes tumbling, Libya being the most recent?
Well, Libya is it's a source of great frustration to me because it's probably the place I have written the most about and never visited. I've never been there.
Fascinating.
And I would love to be there now.
Why have you written so much about it? What fascinates you most about it?
Well, there are two chapters in the book that CBS Pentagon correspondent David Martin and I wrote a couple of decades ago about terrorism, mm-hmm. about an earlier chapter in international terrorism. There are two chapters about Libya, and I haven't seen much of it in the press nowadays, but the list of American grievances, the list of Americans that he has killed through proxies like the Abu Nidal organization,
right.
which is now defunct, thank goodness, is very, very long. I mean, it goes back to people like 11-year-old Natasha Simpson at the Rome airport. That was an attempt to go after, I think, the El Al ticket counter.
Right.
And the security guards caught onto it, and so they just blasted everybody inside, including 11-year-old Natasha Simpson. Mm-hmm. They finished her off with a second burst to her head. There's a part of me that maybe isn't the best journalism part of me that says, payback time has arrived.
Right.
For all those people on Pan Am 103.
Right.
For the Natasha Simpsons of the world, for the guys at the La Belle Disco in Berlin. We have a long history with this.
We forget about all of that.
And so I'm fascinated to see. And at the same time, I'm fascinated. This is a place where his departure, if it comes, was going to leave a vacuum in a part of the world that is very important to our and the world economy
right.
because of its oil and natural gas.
Right.
And if there's trouble elsewhere, particularly in Egypt affecting the Suez Canal,
right.
Libya's on the near side of the Suez Canal, it becomes even more important. And so instability there, which I'm afraid is likely if he falls, and maybe inevitable now.
Could be even more dangerous than what the devil we live with today.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And he's the devil we know. And so I find all of that fascinating. The other thing I find fascinating about this, and I think the New York Times had a good story about it yesterday. I think Scott Chain wrote it. That Al-Qaeda, about whom we have made so much now for a decade, seems irrelevant. This is not Al-Qaeda at work.
It's such a small, splintered organization. We've already done damage to it.
Well, it's that, and I have long wondered whether Al-Qaeda's goals are shared by the vast majority of what, you know, we colloquially call the Arab street.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do the Arab people en masse want what Al-Qaeda is selling? You know, is their objective the restoration of a
Islamic
9th century Islamic caliphate?
Right.
And I suspect not. And so I'm not sure that what's happening now is good news for Al-Qaeda at all. And I think it suggests that the concerns I had for so many years, and many others had, that we were overplaying Al-Qaeda,
mm-hmm.
overreacting.
Certainly, there's that feeling of retribution that everybody seeks for what happened in 9/11, but there's only so much you can, so many resources you can devote to that over time.
That's right, and there's only so much success you can have, and you look at what's going on in Afghanistan today, and I think it's very hard to be optimistic about the outcome there. And every time I take the metro down to the Pentagon, and it comes up out of the ground in Arlington Cemetery, and I look out there, it's a reminder that, 4,400 of our people and a couple of 100,000 Iraqis, and now we're close to 1,500 more in Afghanistan. And yet the outcomes in both those countries are still
totally uncertain.
Totally uncertain. I agree.
How did Smart Brief start? How did you get involved with it?
I've actually been involved with it as an advisor for about a decade, but it got started with, I think, a recognition of something that's become more and more true over time,
mm-hmm.
which is that, maybe for the first time in the history of civilization, people have too much information. And their problem is not finding information. It's weeding out the good information from the profusion of bad information and finding the information that's relevant to them and to their business.
So first, it's really, who do you trust? What information is accurate?
That's
or
right.
Responsible?
And we use a combination of search technology and human editing. I mean, that's, if there's a secret sauce there, that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
We search the same way everybody else does, although we use some proprietary software to do that, and
mm-hmm.
we're continually upgrading that, and we're in the middle of reviewing some of that now. And a lot of our search is done offshore.
Mm-hmm.
To take advantage of the time difference so that when our editors come to work at 5 a.m,
they can immediately
have a list of sometimes 100 stories to choose from. But the editors go to work at that point. We haven't simply hired some algorithm, nor do we simply give people the stories that are most clicked on. It's not as simple as that. We pay attention to those things.
I actually worked for an organization that did that. It's called Yellow Bricks, and they have a neural networking technology that supposedly uses technology to do that. But taking out the human element altogether really is may not work. And what you're saying is you need to have the human element to provide editorial.
You do. And to go back to what we talked about earlier with Iraq, just by example, a lot of the worst reporting on Iraq and terrorism was in the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
Highly regarded, many people consider it the best newspaper in the country, if not the world. Any algorithm probably would have given primacy to stories in the New York Times.
Right.
And yet they were all wrong. They later had to apologize for them. So it isn't a simple matter of looking at the topic and the source. You have to know something that the human editing element is crucial to this.
We're speaking with John Walcott, Chief Content Officer and Editor-in-Chief of Smart Brief. John, if people want to know more about SmartBrief, how do they find out about it?
SmartBrief.com.
That's easy enough. We're out of time. That was the fastest 15 minutes I've ever spent on the radio. And thank you for being my special guest today.
It's my pleasure, Wayne. Anytime.
We could do this a couple more times and still not get enough information that I have so many questions of you. Thank you again. And thanks to all the listeners for listening to Blueprint for Wealth. Join us next week and have a great week.